You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Heating up a small planet affects everyone, everywhere, no matter who releases the greenhouse gases. I'm always looking for voices outside the bubble of the Western-style consumer culture. Our next guest was born in the Indian megacity of Calcutta. He studied at the Delhi School of Economics and got his PhD at Oxford. Currently, when he has settled anywhere, Amitav Ghosh lives in New York. But Ghosh is most widely known for his writing. His best-selling novels make him one of the souls of India. His mastery of fiction and non-fiction make him a bridge to English readers as well. Here's a powerful introduction of Amitav Ghosh, recorded at the launch of his new book, The Great Derangement. It was in his birthplace of Calcutta.
I am Jag Ghoshini. Amitav Ghosh is the author of such acclaimed fiction as The Circle of Reason, which was, of course, his debut novel, The Shadow Lines, The Calcutta Chromosome, The Glass Palace, The Hungry Tide, and The Ibis Trilogy, Sea of Poppies, River of Smoke, and Flood of Fire. His notable non-fiction writings are In an Antique Land, Dancing in Cambodia and at Large in Burma, Countdown, and The Imam and the Indian. In The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable, which is Amitav's first major book of non-fiction since In an Antique Land, he examines our inability at the level of literature, history, and politics to grasp the scale and violence of climate change. The climate crisis asks us to imagine other forms of human existence, a task to which fiction, Amitav argues, is the best suited of all cultural forms. His book serves as a great writer's summons to confront the most urgent task of our time.
That recording is from the book launch August 1st, 2016 in Calcutta. On YouTube, you can find the whole thought-provoking conversation between Amitav Ghosh and filmmaker Srijit Mukherjee. And I'll put links in my show blog at ecoshock.info so you can find it.
Radio EcoShock.
Amitav Ghosh, it's an honor to have you join us on Radio EcoShock. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex. It's a great pleasure to be with you. I listen to your show all the time. I have the podcast downloaded on my phone, so this is really an honor for me.
Well, I'm really surprised, and I'm really pleased, of course. And it is a good source of climate science news, I think. Now, to get going here, I was in Mumbai back in 1979, when it was still called by its colonial name of Bombay. And since then, you know, the population has doubled to almost 21 million in Metro Mumbai today. Tell us about the risks of climate change to this mega city.
Well, Mumbai is in an extraordinarily vulnerable location, you know, because it's just completely exposed to the sea. It's built on these reclaimed islands. So most of Mumbai is actually, you know, built on reclaimed land now. South Mumbai was, you know, initially just a set of islands, and they've now been linked together. The real problem for Mumbai is two things. One is sea level rise, of course. But the other major problem for Mumbai is that cyclonic activity is increasing greatly in the Arabian Sea. In the past, Bombay, Portuguese Bombay, as well as British Bombay, the city was hit by cyclones fairly regularly. This didn't happen in the 20th century, but it seems that now with the uptick in cyclonic activity in the Arabian Sea, that Mumbai may well be hit in the years to come.
And you've suggested buildings could collapse in the city.
Buildings collapse in Mumbai, as you know, also in other Indian cities and other Asian cities. Buildings collapse anyway. It happens fairly often. And these buildings are not built to resist extraordinary wind speeds or anything of that kind. So, yes, I think if Mumbai were to face a storm like Hurricane Matthew, the results would be completely catastrophic.
And is the city prepared if a storm like Hurricane Sandy hit it?
Not at all. The city is not prepared at all. I went through all the disaster preparation documents that the city has produced. The disaster that Mumbai is preparing for is actually yesterday's disaster, as it were, you know, which was this terrible, this extreme rainfall event that occurred in 2005, when, you know, the city got something like 36 inches of rain in 14 hours. And then there were terrible floods after that and so on. So after that, you know, the city government did try to take cognizance of what had happened, and they've tried to create some documents around it. But that sort of event and a major cyclone would be completely different in their impact.
And Mumbai has a nuclear power plant on either side of it, and I'm worried that a terrible event like the meltdowns in Fukushima, Japan, could happen in India. I mean, all that has to happen is the power grid goes down for long enough, their batteries run out, they can't get their diesel fuel through, and those things can melt down. Is that a genuine fear?
It's certainly a fear for me. It's a fear for me. It's a fear for others who study nuclear safety issues. In a sense, one doesn't want to be excessively alarmist because, as you know, it sort of makes people's minds shut down. So I don't want to sort of be raising a hue and cry about that, but it's certainly a very, very, it's a possibility. It's something that could happen.
Well, this sort of dovetails into your book title. You said that climate change is to some degree unthinkable.
I think, yes, climate change is unthinkable according to the manners and procedures of thought that we've developed over the last 200 years. It resists our ways of thinking in many different ways. But equally unthinkable are the sorts of responses it requires from us, you know, managed retreat, changing our lives, changing the ways in which we deal with our ordinary circumstances. Everything in our life, in our collective lives, is really interrogated and questioned and challenged by climate change in a way that has never happened in any other circumstance, I think.
And you recently returned from Chennai on the east coast of India. Tell us about the extreme rainfall event that struck there.
There again, there was this extreme, what they now call a rain bomb. So there was this sort of rain bomb event. Suddenly, you know, a stalled system dumping huge quantities of water on Chennai. The problem for India, of course, is that not just India, but many places in the world, is that human impact and climate impact have both accumulated to the point where really they're both exacerbating each other, you know. So in Chennai, actually, many of the activists don't even really want to talk about the climate change impact because, you know, they're so focused on criticizing the political structures of the city, on focusing on its patterns of development, very misdirected development, where they've built over drainage channels, clogged up, you know, old rivers and creeks and the wetlands. So, you know, in some strange way, because people are focused on that and they should be focused on that, they sometimes don't even want to hear about the climate change impact. Another problem really in relation to India is that, you know, well, not just in relation to India, as you know, really climate science, the whole discourse around climate change tends to be very, very Eurocentric. It's almost completely focused on the West. So attribution studies, for example, really haven't paid much attention to Asia and or other parts of the world. There's been no attribution study, so far as I know, of this rain bomb event in Chennai or even the event that occurred in Mumbai in 2005.
Have the city planners and the developers changed their ways in Chennai to avoid a repeat?
On the contrary, you know, just at the time that I was releasing my book in Chennai, somebody told me this astonishing fact that a developer has just announced a super luxury condominium building, actually in one of the most vulnerable spots. It's at the mouth of a river and, you know, a few hundred yards from the sea. And this super luxury condo is going to have a 7-story basement. What can you say, really? I mean, it's just another symptom of the derangement that we live in.
It is a kind of madness. You know, whether it's Chennai or Miami Beach or New Jersey, after every flood, people and, of course, the politicians promise to rebuild everything exactly in the same dangerous places. How can we go on living in this dream, knowing what we do know from the science of climate change?
It completely boggles the mind, really. I mean, just today, I was reading in a journal article, Dutch engineers talking about Miami, and the word they all use for Miami is doomed. At the same time, you know, some part of my screen, there was an ad going off for this super luxury building on Miami Beach. And people are apparently buying into these buildings. They are making investments in these properties. what can you say? It's really a metaphor for the strange state of mind that we're all in.
And yet, you think literature has somewhat turned away from climate change.
Yes, I think literature has. And that's really what my new book is about. It's about the ways in which climate change really resists the literary forms and even the artistic forms of our time, you know. Because basically these forms were invented in the 19th century, in the early 20th and the mid-20th centuries, when we lived through a period of relative climatic stability. And now, you know, we are in this moment when, you know, the climate is anything but stable. And our forms just haven't caught up. Our forms haven't even begun to catch up. I'll give you an example, if you like.
Please.
I was in Mumbai, again, talking about my book. And I was speaking to a couple, they're very famous artists, very famous, very successful, globally successful artists. And they were telling me about their experiences during the deluge of 2005. Their house was swamped, they lost a lot of work, their child was stranded and they couldn't reach her for 2 days. So it was a traumatic experience for them, you know, in every sense a trauma. And I asked them, I said, so has this trauma in any way found its way into your work? Have you expressed it in your work? And they were both astonished by the question. I mean, not only had they not addressed this trauma, you know, those floods in their work, the very thought hadn't occurred to them. And the real reason for this is that, you know, if an artist of that stature addresses something like that, then it's considered illustrative, you know, it's considered to be an illustration, if you like, of surroundings or whatever. And that illustration is now a real pejorative in the vocabulary of art criticism. And if the pejorative had been applied to their work, they would have lost their market. Their work would not have been taken seriously from that point on. So do you see what I'm saying? We have reached a point where really our art, the very mode of our art, refused to let us engage with our surroundings.
A serious situation. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is the legendary author Amitav Ghosh with his new book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. In your book, you trace your own beginning path to climate awareness to a strange weather event in Delhi. Tell us about that.
Yes. Let me say straight away that weather event had no connection to climate change that I know of. This happened in 1978, so a long time ago. It was a day of very strange weather in Delhi University. I was a student there. I was also working as a journalist. I was in a library. And, you know, the weather was so strange. Suddenly there was a hailstorm and it stopped. So I decided to go back to the room that I was living in. And I took a very unusual route, a route that I didn't usually take because I wanted to just stop by and see a friend. And the weather kept getting worse. Then I sort of headed off. And as I was walking down a road, I glanced over my shoulder and I saw this strange sort of like a finger reaching down from the sky. And as I was watching, it sort of came whiplashing down to earth, you know, behind me on this road. So I ran for cover. I first went to this big plate glass door. There were many people cowering there, and there was no room for me. So then I went around to the side, and I sort of took shelter under an overhang. After a while, there was this incredible noise. I looked up, and I saw things just whirling through the sky, you know, tea stalls, bicycles, asbestos roofs, because there were a lot of asbestos roofs in Delhi in those days. And it just lasted a moment, and then it was over. And it was, of course, a tornado. But a tornado had never before struck Delhi. Tornadoes are completely unfamiliar in that part of the world. So, you know, none of us even knew what to call it. The next day, in the newspapers, it was called a cyclone, in fact, because nobody knew the right word for it. But it killed 30 people. Many of the people who were around me were injured. So I was extraordinarily fortunate. But you know, I've written about this in the book because what I was trying to address is this idea of the unprecedented, you know, the unfamiliar, the uncanny. Because just think about it. there I was walking down a street, and suddenly a completely unprecedented, historically unprecedented phenomenon suddenly touches down right on top of me almost, you know. And for years afterwards, I tried to write about it, but its very unlikeliness, the very nature of the phenomenon was such that I couldn't actually bring myself to put it into a book. Because you know how in novels it's often said that if you put this in a book, nobody would believe it. And that's actually the case, that the sort of whole calculus of probability that exists in contemporary fiction is such that even ordinarily unlikely events become very difficult to put into a book because they just seem so improbable. And in my book, the argument that I make is that it's this calculus of probability that is in itself one of the factors about climate change that resists the techniques of the modern novel.
And you read a lot of science for your 2004 fiction book, The Hungry Tide. What was that book about?
Well, the book is about, the book is set in the Sundarbans, the vast mangrove forest in India. It's actually in Bengal, and I am myself by origin a Bengali. And I spent a lot of time in this forest, even as a child, because one of my uncles worked in it. And I've been returning to it over the years. So my book, The Hungry Tide, is actually about an Indian-American cephalologist, specialist on marine mammals, a young girl who's doing research for her PhD. And she goes to the Sundarban to study the Irrawaddy dolphin, you know, which is it's a freshwater dolphin, though some members also live in saltwater. So she goes there and she encounters, again, a cyclone. This is a very cyclone-prone region. So, you know, that's the general background.
An awe-inspiring part of your thoughts, I think, on climate involves a still larger pattern of populations all over the world moving towards the seas at the exact time in history when that is a very dangerous place to be, the interface between the seas and the land. Why do you think that migration away from the inland agricultural lands happened?
Well, one of the obvious reasons, of course, is the intensification of trade. And the argument that I make in the book is that if you look at, say, pre-17th century cities, even the major ports were not built directly on the sea. I mean, like London, for example, you know, it's separated from the sea by a long stretch of the River Thames. That's true of Guangzhou. It's true of the many of major port cities, ancient port cities of Asia. Really, the whole trend of building cities right on the sea starts under the European expansion that begins, you know, the 16th century onwards. And many of the cities that are now most threatened were actually built in the 17th century. So, for example, New York and Mumbai come into the possession of the British Empire in the 1660s. And these are both cities that are now directly threatened by climate change. But again, you have in the 19th century another major wave of city building. Again, many cities were built right on the water in this period. In the U.S., of course, you have Chicago, then there's Singapore, Hong Kong, many other cities are like that. And these cities, again, you know, are today extremely at risk from sea level rise. So in the book, I'm just sort of tracing these patterns of how is it that at a certain point in time, people suddenly decide that it's a good idea to live close to the sea. And as we see now, you know, this pattern is actually accelerating. More and more people are moving closer and closer to the sea. And the consequences in the long run are certainly going to be disastrous.
Yes, I'm told that about 50% of the American population now live within 100 miles of either the Atlantic or the Pacific coast. Well, Amitav, we've talked a lot about rising seas and storms, but global warming does mean global warming. And just this summer, India experienced its hottest temperature ever recorded. What is the threat of heat to India?
It's enormous. I mean, you know, the temperatures this summer were unprecedented. I mean, like 51 degrees centigrade, you know, not far from Delhi. Delhi and, you know, cities near Calcutta experienced temperatures of 47 to 49 degrees centigrade. You know, these are temperatures in the 120s in Fahrenheit. temperatures at which really people can't be exposed to the sun for more than 15-20 minutes without becoming completely dehydrated. But there are two things that are very interesting about these heat waves. One is that, of course, the heat wave also coincided with this epic drought, where hundreds of thousands of farmers from certain interior regions in India started abandoning their lands and moving to cities. Literally, in a very short period, millions of farmers left their land and moved to the cities. You know, what we don't realize about these migrations is that when a traditional farmer, someone who's farmed all their lives and who knows by observing their fathers and their grandfathers and grandmothers, you know, farming the land, they learn all these techniques. So when they move away, really we lose a huge amount of agricultural knowledge. And this knowledge can never be restored. Those people will probably now settle in the cities. They'll never go back to their farmlands. And, you know, a huge trove of knowledge is lost. And this is something that's happening not just in India, but also in the U.S. You know, last year I was invited to the University of Indiana, you know, to talk about my books and so on. But I had some very interesting interactions with the students there. Now, as you know, the University of Indiana was originally an agricultural institution with a great focus on agriculture, and many of the students are from rural Indiana. And I was talking to them, and I said, "So, what do you guys want to do in the future? How many of you are from a farming background?" And many of them, maybe more than half, were from farming backgrounds. So I asked them, "What do you want to do in the future?" And all of them, literally all of them, said, "We want to move to New York." You know. So if this gigantic migration takes place and continues to accelerate, I think we are looking at a circumstance where really who's going to be left to produce the food?
Monsanto.
Monsanto. That's exactly it. You know, there's a huge sort of hemorrhaging of human capital and human knowledge that's occurring and that we are not paying attention to. The other thing which really struck me about the heat wave in India, I was in Delhi, you know, very shortly after the heat wave, and I had a meeting with some young journalists. There were 30 or 40 very bright young journalists there, and we were talking, you know, about climate change and so on. And I asked them, I said, how many of you wrote about the heat wave? And, you know, a couple of them had, you know, sort of written short pieces about the temperatures. But there were no other stories. You know, none of them had written any sort of long-form story. None of them had, you know, even gone out and reported about it. And I think that is really the problem. How do you write a story, even just a journalistic story, about a heat wave? What's your story? How do you put people in it? And this is where I think really, you know, the arts are failing us. Literature is failing us. If the great literary minds of our time can't think of these stories, how can you expect, you know, busy, rushed young journalists to go out and tell these stories?
Amitav Ghosh, you don't think highly of the climate agreement reached in Paris in late 2015. Why not?
Well, in the first place, there are multiple reasons. I don't think it's actually going to achieve the goals that it claims to. But anyway, I'm not an expert on that. I think to me there are two things which are really profoundly disappointing about this agreement. One is that it makes literally almost no mention of climate justice. There's only one sentence in it where climate justice is obscurely referred to, and it's sort of parenthesized as something which is of interest only to a few. As we know, justice is absolutely a central issue in climate change, and it has, if in effect, what this Paris Agreement achieved was to sweep the whole issue of justice under the carpet. So that is really one major problem as far as I'm concerned. The second major problem is that nowhere in the document do they even speak of climate change as a market failure, which actually occurs in the Kyoto Protocol and in earlier iterations of these agreements. But here it's completely absent. So there's no question here. Never is the question confronted that should we change our lifestyles? Do we need to think about our ways of living in new and alternative forms? Those questions are never broached. They're never addressed. In fact, what this Paris Agreement does, in my view, is that it's a direct descendant of, all these other free trade agreements like TARP and NAFTA and so on. It deploys exactly the same language. And what it's aimed at is really, it's aimed at creating business opportunities around climate change. So in a way, what it is that it's a neoliberalization of climate change. And I think, that's not going to help or work in the long run.
I think we'll still go well over 2 degrees with that, if that's our best hope. And speaking of hope, do you think there is hope for us?
That's the question that actually I've heard you asking many of the scientists that you interview, and I think they're much better placed to address it than I am. But one thing I've certainly noticed is that, where on the question of hope, the answers that you usually get from climate scientists and so on is geared actually to politics more than to actuality, as it were. I mean, there are people who feel that if you present a sort of panicky view of what's ahead, then that's unfruitful. On the other hand, there are people who feel that unless you raise the alarm, people won't respond. As far as I can see, neither of these approaches has worked.
Yes, well, you call it the Great Derangement, so obviously you're quite concerned.
Yes, of course. But I really admire activists like Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, and so on, and I really admire the work they do, and I try and support it in whatever way, but I don't think of myself as an activist.
Well, I think writing is an activist act, and certainly you'll communicate with millions of people with your new book. As we end our time together, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I think one of the most important things I'm trying to say in the book is that, the whole sort of climate issue has been increasingly sort of conceptualized as a matter of wealth, People don't want to sacrifice their wealth. That's why they deny climate change and so on. This is a position that you'll hear many activists take. But I think what is even more important than wealth in this matter is actually power. What underlies the global distribution of power today is fossil fuels in many ways. And once fossil fuel consumption changes, it will also change the distribution of power. And I think this is the central anxiety that actually prevents countries like the United States and Australia and so on from moving on climate change. It's not about lifestyles in the end. I think it's really about who gets to, as it were, run the world system.
The fiction and nonfiction works of Amitav Ghosh are read by many millions of people. His latest is a deeply thought-out look at the inner and outer perils of climate change. It's called The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. You can find out more at amitavghosh.com or find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. If I may just point out, the book is published in the U.S. by the University of Chicago Press.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.